Today's topics are going to be issues that focus on, while all day long we do great work to do planning and to protect against outsiders that you think will attack plaintiffs' lawyers, divorce situations, and so forth, where do we have risk in two areas that we think there's probably generally no risk at all? Within the family, or, for example, assets that are offshore and foreign jurisdictions, and what risks we have there as well. Or the employment of generation skipping tax. Areas that don't typically come up in our typical planning, but are worthy of bringing up. And as we continue to evolve in our practice and serve, we will probably have this become part of our questionnaire as well to trigger things. I mean, we always ask, you know, what assets do you have overseas? Do you intend to expect to inherit assets? Do you expect to move overseas? Are there any family members of yours that you think could potentially be jealous or could be estranged or be resentful of someone serving? So some of these things for sure come up, but we want to keep this front and center because for us, particularly as our state administration department moves more to doing more complex work, at any given time we have at least a few dozen estate administrations moving forward. And so it is a separate independent part of the firm with a team of people whose job is strictly to make sure that these are handled efficiently. You're not counting on myself or any of our planners. These are people who are expert at that. And Elizabeth, as you know, in our office, Elizabeth Boyd, who runs that department. So there has been input from her and me, and Dominic and Ben and John and the rest of the team on pieces that we've all seen. So, number one, will manipulated by third party and abuse of durable powers of attorney, the undue influence of family members. So it's not unusual to know that everyone has moved away, but one child, maybe never married, maybe married, is doing the majority of the work for mom's estate if mom is a survivor. Maybe there's a friend of the family. Maybe there is a person from the church or the temple. Maybe there is a nurse that's coming from the state. These are opportunities to take advantage of the infirmed, those of diminished capacity, maybe not completely lacking capacity, and to unjustly enrich one party and effectively undermine the plan. One of the classics is having a joint account and saying, Mom, you know, let's put my name on the $200,000 account. I'll write all your checks out. And then Mom says, well, of course, you'll divide that with your sisters and brothers. Sure. And that never happens. So we have to be very focused that after Mom passes away, that piece passes to that child by operation of law. And there's really very little success in getting that account moved into the overall estate to be divided among everyone. In other words, with the power of attorney, Mom, I want to use the power of attorney, or, you know, Mrs. Smith, you know, I can help you with the power of attorney by writing out your checks for you and, you know, taking it to the bank. And then we find out that the power of attorney is used to move money into individual names. And it's, again, a hard battle here because how do we know that grandma of, quote, diminished capacity intended it or not? So when there is a unique and special and trusted relationship with one child or one individual in the community and transfers are taking place during the lifetime of grandma, there are special rules, or at least the law favors protecting the other family members because they say that that child having that protective relationship could have unduly influenced the grandma of diminished capacity. But you want to avoid being in those situations or at least be on the lookout for them and maybe having multiple people on the power of attorney that require signatures, ensuring that grandma doesn't put money in joint accounts without clearly intending that that's going to go to that one child and only to that child. Okay, number two, marshaling and valuing international assets for tax purposes. So a big part of estate administration, of course, is to collect all the assets, and we have many clients who have assets overseas. Maybe it's their first-generation immigrants, and they have a bank account or some securities accounts in the country of their origin. So my wife being Portuguese, you know, her parents emigrated here and then maintain a home back in Portugal. So if and when they pass away, there are bank accounts, there's work that has to be done. First of all, we cannot lose sight of the fact of the FBAR requirements, which are disclosure of all accounts that you have overseas. And so every one of our clients has to be mindful of this piece. There are very few exemptions. If you have assets overseas, you have to notify the government. In fact, this week is the deadline on an annual basis for the FBAR filing. The second piece that's important, though, is that it's hard to collect these assets because you have to translate executors' letters or letters of trusteeship into the language of the country where the assets are in. You have to convince these banks to release them. Remember, they prefer to keep the money there. The old, Beverly Hillbillies, where Mr. Drysdale did not want any of the money of the Clampets to leave his bank, and he would, you know, lie in the street before he would let that money leave. And so these banks have, a subtle spin on that as well, where they, too, want to make it difficult for you to take the money out. It is important, and ahead of time, to let us know if you have the assets overseas, and we have many times put them into trust. We can avoid the European or the Asian ancillary probate if in certain instances, and for sure we can at least be prepared in advance as to the processes we need to do with the local banks when these accounts are over there. But nonetheless, we still have to know what their values are, date of death, and we need to disclose that to the IRS within the 9-month period, 8 months for the local state jurisdictions. Number three is generation skipping tax exemptions. Many years ago, the laws passed, not that many, but at least over a decade ago, the laws changed to say, look, there are wonderful exemptions to allow assets to pass not just from mom and dad or grandma and grandpa to mom and dad to grandchildren free of tax through taking advantage of the generation skipping tax exemption. The problem was that people were not using, when they were creating their trust, they were not using these generation skipping tax exemptions. And they were failing to. The lawyers were failing to it. The clients were failing to it. So then after a trust passed the children, it was going to be subject to tax before it got to the grandchildren. So the government came along and said, look, we're going to impose an automatic allocation. And way back then, many of us practitioners were high-fiving each other saying, that's awesome. Let's get the automatic allocation. This avoids malpractice on our part or, the client making that mistake. So that, this asset will go generation skipping tax-free from grandma and grandpa to children and all the way down to grandchildren and beyond. The problem is, as with anything that gets too unwieldy, whether it's vines growing on the side of your house or a plant, the generation skipping automatic tax exemption of the allocation, the automatic allocation, can be hurtful. Because we do many trusts in this office, and so maybe there's a trust we've set up for life insurance, or maybe there's a trust that we've set up for your second residence. But those assets, by the time they get down to the grandchildren, or by the time they pass the children, do not have a significant amount of future gain in them, and so these accounts, sadly, have had the automatic allocation. And the generation skipping tax exemption is going to less efficient assets because it's automatic. And so there is a very important piece to be clear with us, and it's very important for us to talk to you about it over time, to say what assets are we putting in this trust, and do we want to deploy the generation skipping tax exemption? And we have to look at what we think is going to grow the most by the time it gets to your grandkids and what will continue to grow in your grandkids and your great-grandkids' names. The generation skipping tax exemption is wonderful, and it was great that they changed the rule many years ago to make an automatic allocation. It is difficult when you get to our level of sophisticated planning because we wind up having to review and potentially undo these allocations for the benefit of using them for more efficient matters. Okay, we're on to number four. Distribution to charities and notifying the Attorney General and government agencies. So we all favor, of course, seeing you give gifts to charities. Of course, we also say the charity begins at home, so we want to take care of families first. A big part of what our future at the firm is and why Dominic in our office is working with me on this and what my anticipation is going to be for the second half of my professional career as I cross 25 years of practice is to do more work in preparing heirs for their inheritance and preparing heirs to be more efficient about doing outward thinking things, helping others. And that means through charities and doing family foundations and charitable trusts. Great stuff. It keeps the family together. It's a disciplined and organized way of assuring that they are focused on their family, but also focusing on others. And it's not during the holiday events. It's not during reviewing, you know, who should be getting distributions for the trust, but it is just about these charities. Well, that's great, except we do have work that has to be done when you leave assets to charity. You still have to notify the Attorney General's office of gifts that you're making to charitable trust. We have to make sure that these gifts do comply with federal and state regulations. Are these charities still officially 501c3s, which is the federal tax designation to assure that it is a legitimate charity? So we have homework to do, and we have to stay on top of this because certain charities fold, and we always protect that under the will and the trust to say, you know, or its successor, but maybe there isn't a successor charity, and are we happy with the successor charity? So for sure, when we're making charitable gifts, we have to be mindful that there is additional responsibility. Okay, next is fiduciary's responsibility to preserve the estate. So we've, over the years, have clients, and even my own grandfather left assets to his wife and to my mother and her siblings, certain stocks. They liked Pfizer, they liked Coca-Cola, they liked other companies that even today, you know, 50 years later, some people still review them as their darlings. So the question then is, and the lawyer that transferred those assets to my mother said, do you want to keep them in the positions of Pfizer? You know, well, my father had it, I want it, I want my kids to have it. But maybe there's a period when that stock has suffered. Maybe the CEO of that company has performed bad acts. Maybe there are other reasons why not to keep it. And so the general rule is to liquidate the assets immediately as the executor to preserve these assets for the beneficiaries. Now, if the assets go up in value, well, you're looking like, well, maybe you've missed out on some gain. But I can assure you if the assets go down in value, you are in greater trouble with your beneficiaries because they could consider bringing an action for your failure to act appropriately and surcharge you. So there is sometimes an emotional attachment to keeping certain things. Maybe it's an antique automobile that you want to leave to one family member. Maybe it's a piece of real estate that's been in the family. But you must, when you are serving as executor, receive permission, in my mind, or at least work through some kind of organized, accountable way that the beneficiaries know that if you're keeping assets, they've all agreed to do that. We are in situations often where we have clients who have been successful in certain corporations and have, I'll use the word, a ton of stock in one concentrated position. Very common. And while the sophisticated financial advisors are always telling them, sell that stock and diversify, they have chosen because of their emotional commitment to the company or because they don't want to pay the gains tax or because they don't want to do charitable vehicles like charitable remainder trust and charitable lead trust where they can sell the stock and not pay tax. They've chosen to keep that concentrated position in the family. And so when they die, the good news is they get a step up in basis as long as the stock didn't collapse during their lifetime. But now the children have this stock in Exxon or in J.P. Morgan or in Goldman Sachs. And now the question is, if they're disproportionately weighted in one position, all the more reason to be careful. I mean, we watched what happened with Bear Stearns and with Lehman Brothers. Imagine if you were the executor and your client died and the decedent died and there was $5, $10, $15 million of Lehman Brothers stock and, you know, the stock is evaporating before your eyes. You know, a very, very tough situation to be in, and it's critical to address those concentrated positions before the client passes away, and also we would love to see them diversify and put it into a charitable trust, but certainly immediate afterwards to talk to all the family members. Okay, we're on to number six. Six is significant gifts made during lifetime can affect intended outcome of the estate plan. So you say, I love all my children equally, but there's one that seems to come by the house more frequently for apple pie, and so I'm always happy to make pie. We get it. You know, there's one that may be around more, and you may decide that to give them certain gifts. This is a very, very tricky thing, though, because if your plan says, when I die, I leave all my assets to the three of my children, but then you make a significantly large gift to one child or a piece of artwork or a piece of real estate or a bank account, that may have been your intention. You know, it does serve, without a full explanation to the other children, it does serve to create dissension and resentment and just overall disputes in the family, and that's the last gift or curse you want to give to your children. So it is important that if you're going to consider making that gift, you want to paper it on, you know, with us. Furthermore, your children, the non-benefited children may say, you know, Susie was with mom all the time. She was in that protected, trusted situation, and the courts, you know, frown upon that when gifts are made to Susie. And they could fight to undo that. So number one is you should protect your children, your other children, and explain why certain gifts were made. Number two is that if you don't and your other children don't understand that, your children could then sue Susie, that one child, and say that given in your special relationship with mom and that confidential relationship that was continuous and we were not around, you abused that and you unduly influenced mom into giving a piece of property to you. And there's a good chance that they would have at least a reasonable case on that. Okay, number seven. Failure to use a firm familiar with the sophistication of planning documents to administer the estate, and failure to correctly interpret the documents. As you know, in our documents, we're very focused on clearly laying out, you know, who it is that you want to represent you, and laying those pieces out. You know, who better to go to when you are buying a Lexus than the Lexus manufacturers and the Lexus mechanics, because this is what they eat, breathe, and sleep the car that they're building. Of course, the same for every other high quality or automobile and in general. The issue is that occasionally, fortunately for us, we've seen situations when a client has passed, not a client of ours has passed away, and one of the executors chooses their friend who's a lawyer who may not fully understand how to interpret the document, who may not understand the subtleties of what was intended by grandma, and we have found ourselves in a position where we've had to jump in and clean up the messes because, the decedent has now passed away. The drafter of the will, the lawyer, is not in the picture. And the new lawyer doesn't have the level of sophistication. So it is important to, again, tell your friends and family that they should choose ahead of time what law firm they want. We think it's misguided when they say, I'll just have my executor choose who they want. That is dangerous. You've spent all this time laying out your assets. You've spent all this time choosing your representatives. And now you're going to count on your one representative's ability to choose the lawyer or the administrator. Again, it doesn't happen much with us. Our clients want us to do it, and as we have done for years. But I think it's very important that you keep that message on to your friends. Okay, next. is personal property disputes after the death of a loved one, fighting in the families over whether to sell items or keep them or memorialize items. This can be one of the most stressful areas filled with consternation, and the person who is the executor, it's a thankless job. You know, family members say, I want all of Mom's shirts, or I want all of her jewelry, or why can't I have all the furniture? Or I want the artwork, or how come you got the artwork? We think that it is important, particularly when you have items of import that you lay out, and we say for sure identify all those personal items that are of import, because we never want someone to steal them after, you know, it's determined that you've passed away. We try to have the houses sealed up right away, because even in the Michael Jackson estate, the family members were trying to get in and take rugs and other things from the house because there's no accountability. It's not like taking out $500,000 from a Goldman Sachs account. You know, that's all monitored. The issue here is, so first we want to protect it, but then the second thing is who gets what? And so laying, so first you want to inventory. The second is you want to lay out who should get what piece. And some people, the children, sometimes the grandma and grandpa, or the parents, you know, they feel like, you know, they're wishing ill, or that they're counting the days. And we're not saying that. You know, my mother-in-law, you know, years before she passed away, walked around with my wife and my brother-in-law and said, you know, we have this little sliver of property here in northern Portugal. We have this piece here. These are the items of value in the family. You guys can work those up together. Important, very, very, very important to lay those out. It should not be viewed necessarily as something that is morbid or that is prognosticating what the immediate future is or foreshadowing. So important to lay those pieces out. And to identify to your children that whoever you put in charge, it's their final say. So that if we want to sell the furniture, if we want to sell you know, other items of personal property, it's in the house. Now, as an executor, your job is ends. It's a finite amount of time, but your siblings are with you for the rest of your life. And what we hate to see is mom and dad putting together a great estate and the children fighting and never recovering. And so discussions as executors should not be from a purely autocratic way. I read a great article the other day in The Economist, which was talking about bosses and their job to be responsible, you know, as stewards of the firm. And one quote was, the most effective boss is the fearful boss, you know, the one that wants to please the people that he works with. And in some respects, the effective executor is the fearful executor. Not that they should demonstrate weakness or contrition or even fear to their loved one, but to say, what do I gain by acting autocratically here? And to understand that their loved ones chose them because of their discerning abilities, their judgment, but not to be in a position when everyone is already mourning the loss of the loved one to then compound that by being lacking sensitivity to the fact that the other family members are mourning also, and that they may demonstrate their sadness by saying, I wanted Mom's jewelry. And the executive's job is to have a delicate hand. I mean, this is where some of our greatest work, and one of the reasons Elizabeth has done such phenomenal work, because she works with a high touch, and the practice works that way as well. All that work with her, Donica and Dominic and John Kiley, all know that we have to be extremely sensitive to these people who've been hit over the head with a 2x4 when their family has left them. And we have to be respectful and sensitive that it may not surface in ways I'm mourning the loss of my mother or father. It surfaces in, I'm extremely angry at my sister, the executor. So we want to work with that. In fact, we probably should do workshops. Last two pieces, failure to title assets correctly, joint accounts. A very, very critical part of our 10-step wealth and family values transfer process is the step that talks about the post-execution asset allocation and beneficiary designation call. And John Kiley runs the post-execution work and our compliance department. And you will be speaking with him or with one of the people that works with John on making sure that all your accounts are correctly titled. In fact, we prepare a letter and we deliver that direction letter to you and we say, here are how things need to be done. When you open up new accounts, you have to reach us and tell us, how do we title it? You have to involve us with your financial advisors so that they know to pick up the phone and how to title it. Too often, accounts are opened inadvertently, and you've named a beneficiary, or you've named a joint account holder on it, and those beneficiary designations and joint accounts override everything we do in your wills. So if you have $1 million and you name your child as a beneficiary on that, and or you've named your child as a joint account holder, we talked about this before, after we've done the allocations for you, it is important that you reach us and let us know what your intentions are. It is the quickest way to undermine the estate, intentionally or unintentionally. You must let us know exactly how they're titled so that we can assure that. You must remember these accounts, go after your accountants, go after your tax returns, list every one of those, particularly if it's an account that's overseas. If you don't remember, this is stuff that you may find painful, but somebody's going to do it, whether you're alive or after you're alive, and it's a lot harder after you pass away. Okay, number 10. Are there significant assets, liquid assets available to continue to operate the family business, to preserve the family retreat, and to pay the estate taxes? So, you know, we have done great work for you all in putting assets into trust. You have, maybe it's real estate, maybe it's a family business, maybe it's in a partnership. These are all getting these assets, as we say, off your balance sheet, over the compound wall, avoiding tax, you know, out of your front yard, as we say, with the acorns and putting them, tossing them into your kids' yards and letting them grow. All of these are extremely valuable ways of minimizing the taxes. But once they're in the trust, and you're no longer alive, who is funding that trust? Where is the liquidity coming to pay for the expenses of the beach house? Where is their liquidity coming to pay the monthly income monthly tax payments for the business? What happens if we're tight on money? So we want you to think these things through and say, of course, consider life insurance. You know, I've been saying this for 20 years. Every good thorough plan, estate plan, includes life insurance as a portion of it. It is a wonderful opportunity as a tax-free injection of cash into the estate, provided it's inside a trust, to give that liquidity to the family members to pay expenses, whether they're funeral expenses, whether they're expenses in running the house or the business. But it is important to think about liquidity after you pass away. And, you know, I can remember a situation where we have a personal relationship said, I'm stripping all the cash out of my family business in order to have my children start the business and do it on their own. Well, that was a noble idea to try to have them fully appreciate how things work, but then they had no cash. And so then they were pleading with other family members to get cash to cover their expenses. So we do understand the importance of cash needs and liquidity. We need to keep that in mind for the larger assets.